This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a police reform activist says if cops spend most of their time wasting money and damaging lives by charging people with minor offenses, then it's clear that the U.S. needs to drastically reduce the number of police. And Black radical political scientists discuss the ways capitalism is changing Black lives and the world economy, and not for the better.
But first, the Democrats continue to blame their loss in November on the Russians and have whipped up a new McCarthyism and a war fever of the kind that used to be peculiar to Republicans. It's not a pretty sight. We spoke with Dr. Margaret Flowers, who ran for the U.S. Senate from Maryland on the Green Party ticket.
The Democrats will do anything to avoid addressing the reality that they've been losing and lost this election largely because they abandoned their voter base decades ago, and people will only take so much. And so, you know, this whole Russian hacking is a good way to avoid facing reality. For them, it was disappointing to see that that also was embraced in the recount effort that Dr. Stein did. I've been very public about my opposition to the recount, although I was a big supporter of Dr. Stein during her run and, you know, helped out a lot with that. On this, we largely disagree. This recount effort was something that some Democratic lawyers put together trying to get the Clinton team to engage in. And when the Clinton campaign refused to pick it up, they handed it to Dr. Stein. And without, I think, really thinking strategically about whether that was a wise thing to do, she took off with it. And so now she's kind of stuck with this whole being connected to this whole Russian distraction that's going on right now. But the good part is it has really stirred up conversation within Green Party members about, you know, kind of critical things that we should be talking about and addressing within the Green Party if we're really going to be building power and challenging both of the corporate capitalist parties.
Yeah, what we're seeing coming from ranks that are broadly associated with the Democratic Party is a movement to repudiate Trump, certainly, but a movement that appears, at least rhetorically, to be in line with not an anti-war movement, but a pro more tensions with and more conflicts and confrontations with Russia movement directed from the top.
Yeah, it's really disappointing. And the United States, you know, has been very aggressive towards Russia. And I think that Putin has shown a fair amount of restraint in the face of what we're doing. A lot of people aren't aware of how heavily involved the United States was in the coup in Ukraine, that we're setting up weapons all along the border of Russia, that we're doing military exercises there, and all this kind of anti-Russian sentiment that's going on, you know, within the United States is really being used to lead people into a greater escalation of conflict with Russia. And it's disappointing to see that people so easily, you know, you think by now people would recognize the signs when they're being led into another conflict, but no, they're eating it up, unfortunately.
And what about the Green Party in terms of a general assessment by the party as to why it got about 1% of the vote in the election? What were the factors and what kind of level of discussions going on in the party?
Yeah, so, you know, there's been this tension within the party. When Ralph Nader ran in 2000, you know, he had the most successful Green Party presidency. And of course, then people in the Green Party were blamed for electing Bush, even though that wasn't the case. I wish it had been the case. You know, to me, the ability to impact elections shows that a party has power and that it is forced to be reckoned with and something to embrace. But instead, people kind of ran away from that. And so ever since then, there's been this tension within the party. Are we truly an independent party that challenges both corporate parties, or are we just kind of there to raise issues, but we don't really want to help elect Republicans. We kind of take a safe approach to protect Democrats. And so this recount effort has really drawn that debate out into the open. And now there are internal conversations happening about how do we build a stronger party that's going to be effective and have greater power. And I think that's what we need is that when we don't differentiate ourselves from the Democrats, then there's really no reason for people to be drawn to the Green Party. And if we aren't really willing to challenge the Democrats, if we ourselves embrace kind of lesser evilism, then it only makes sense for other people to do that as well. So I think, and a number of us think, that it is really critical that we differentiate ourselves from the Democrats, that we take a strong stance of challenging both corporate parties, and that we really put forth a bold agenda that would draw people in. And I think that's what's going to be necessary to really grow. I think that Dr. Stein did a good job in the campaign of trying to make it clear during the campaign that both Clinton and Trump are evils. They may be a little bit different in their evil ways, but they're both very evil. And I think that when it comes to running as an alternative party, there's just so many obstacles that we face, from just getting on the ballot to getting media attention to being included in the debates to having the resources to really do the things that we need. So it's a constant effort. And I think there's a lot of conversation going on in the party as well about how do we kind of build a stronger base, make it a dues-paying base so we have the resources to do the work that we need to do. And I think that as we kind of get this more together, I think that we'll be more strongly positioned in the future. And I think that it's going to be really critical in 2020 that we have to build a stronger party and be very clear, because there's going to be a lot of temptation. If Trump runs again, people will be, you know, it'll be another anybody but year. And whoever the Democrats throw up there, however bad they are, they'll be considered better than a Trump. So it's going to be another challenge that we're facing 4 years from now.
Yes, many folks who call themselves Greens still run from the term spoiler rather than saying, yes, we do want to disrupt your corporate duopoly game and open space for a different kind of political process.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, we are in a challenging time here in the United States where it really is going to be important. And it's happening around the world, not just in the U.S., but really important that the people on the left find a way that we can work together and really be clear about our independence and work to really impact elections, get more people elected, even if we can't get people elected, have some impact that shows our power, that means that people who are in the corporate parties might have to work a little bit to get elected. That would be a nice thing to have to see them do. But we're in a time when if we want to stop this marching to the right, we're going to have to find ways on the left that we can unify and work together.
And that's why I have to return to the question, how are we going to have a renewed anti-war movement when so many folks who are associated with anti-war are joining a bandwagon that just wants to shriek at the Russians?
Yeah, that's the dilemma, isn't it? I mean, that's why it's so important. And we do this at Popular Resistance, trying to dispel these myths. And I know you do that as well at Black Agenda Report. And that's what we have to do, is continue to get the truth out there and get people to face up to these realities and stop falling into the lies that are constantly used to drive us into these wars. So it is a huge challenge.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers of the Green Party speaking from Baltimore. Police reform activist Robert Ganji is considering a run for mayor of New York City to challenge the broken windows policing policies adopted by supposedly liberal mayor Bill de Blasio. Robert Ganji is director of PROP, the Police Reform Organizing Project. He's been sending teams of young investigators and activists to the city's courts to document what actually happens to New Yorkers caught in the jaws of the criminal justice system. Ganji says that, frankly, most cases that come into the courts are crap.
Right. That's a term we use sometimes, the same old crap. And we've been doing the core monitoring work, which is the work you just described, where PROP volunteers and representatives go into the arraignment parts of the city's criminal courts, the four major criminal courts, Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, and Queens, and we observe and record who is being arraigned. And the value of that is manifold. One is everyone who gets arrested in New York has to be arraigned. So if you go into the arraignment parts of the four major courts on a regular enough basis, you will have a very good idea and an undeniably accurate idea of the NYPD's arrest practices. The other advantage is the arraignment courts are open to anybody. You can just walk in. And it's striking that we are the only outside people, outside agents, who are ever in the arraignment parts other than people directly involved in the cases, other than an attorney, a police officer, or the family of the arrested people. Nobody else is monitoring it. Nobody else is reporting on it.
So in the arraignment process, you're looking at the system in the raw, so to speak.
Exactly.
As in the raw as anything other than the arrest itself.
That's right. That's a really, I think, accurate way of thinking about it. And it reflects its political value, political in the sense of we're able to determine what the police are doing and then able to report on it. And it's part of our aggressive effort to expose the blatant racist impact of quota-driven broken windows policing, which is the kind of law enforcement practiced in New York City.
Well, what kind of law enforcement is practiced in New York City as evidenced by what you see at arraignment?
Most of the people that are arraigned, and we go into the misdemeanor courts for the most part, are charged with low-level infractions. Rarely, and I'm not overstating this, rarely, if ever, do we see anyone who we or other observers could possibly characterize as being dangerous or predatory. And they're charged with, again, low-level infractions. Could be suspended license, could be marijuana possession. It could be what's called theft of services, which is fare evasion on the subways in particular. Could be petty larceny, which is basically shoplifting. Sometimes it could be as insignificant as having your foot up on a subway seat or carrying an open alcohol container, riding a bike on a sidewalk. So, again, all low-level infractions, almost any time we go into the courtroom, at least 85%. Sometimes it's 95%, sometimes it's 100%. The last two court visits I made, one to the Bronx, one to Manhattan, 100% of the people were New Yorkers of color. So what our court monitoring work shows is that the cops are engaged in blatantly racist practices that do little, if anything, to contribute to public safety, and practices that do harm to people every day.
And if that is the case, if that is what is taking up most of police time and most of the expense of police, well, we don't need all of these police then, do we?
Point well taken, Glenn. One of the things we're looking very seriously at is the electoral campaigns next year in New York City. All the citywide offices are up for grabs. Mayor, public advocate, controller. We're thinking very seriously of mounting a protest candidacy against Mayor de Blasio, focused on racial and social justice issues, focused on the need for fundamental and far-reaching changes to our criminal justice system. We haven't made a decision yet, but we're, again, thinking seriously about it. I may be the candidate, Glenn.
Well, we see that much of the street-level policing that Mayor de Blasio seemed to be running against still happens. And up there in the Bronx, we've seen the biggest sweep in New York City history.
Right.
120
right.
Young men on conspiracy
right.
charges.
Right. All black and brown young men. Many, many of cases against them are very flimsy. A lot of them, if not all of them, are being held without bail. We are concerned that they're not getting proper or sufficient legal representation. The policing practices that de Blasio has embraced like that kind of raid on a housing project, indiscriminately arresting people without sufficient evidence. That would hold up if certainly if you were arresting well-to-do people, well-to-do white people who had connections and who had high-powered lawyers representing them. He's embraced broken windows policing, despite all the evidence that it is, again, a blatantly racist practice. And it's, the evidence is, we supply it when we do the court monitoring work, but we're just reporting on what happens. And then we also supply it because we analyze the NYPD's own arrest statistics. And their own arrest statistics document the blatantly racist nature of their practices. Their own numbers show that last year, for example, 92.5% of the people that the police officers arrested for the sale or possession of small amounts of marijuana, 92.5% were New Yorkers of color, even though the research shows that white people use and sell the drug in equal or greater proportions to African Americans and Latinos. Bratton has claimed, de Blasio's claimed, that the NYPD does not target communities of color, it targets conduct, and that is, again, I'm using the word undeniable, undeniably false. And again, all you have to do to know that it's false is look at their own numbers, which expose the painful reality that these are racist practices. So part of the reason we're thinking, or the main reason we're thinking seriously about a mayoral candidacy next year, is to get these issues more into the public debate and challenge de Blasio directly, in that he is making claims that he's taking steps to reform policing practices and to improve policing practices and to improve the relationship between the community and the police department. And all of those claims are misstated at best, false at worst. And we're assessing that it would be politically useful in terms of advancing the cause of justice to challenge him directly in an electoral process.
The buzzword that administrations use, even in cities that have the worst records in terms of policing, is community policing. Right. What form, if any, does that take in New York City?
Well, de Blasio is claiming, and Joseph O'Neill, who's the new commissioner who succeeded Bill Brand, is claiming that they're embarking on a neighborhood policing program in the city. And neighborhood policing, like community policing, which was the term used in previous administrations for the kind of policing they were initiating, it's all wine in a new bottle. The same abuses, the same discriminatory practices take place under its rubric. As long as the police department pursues whatever kind of spin they put on the kind of policing they do, pursues broken windows policing, driven by a quota system, there will be no significant changes, no meaningful changes. It really is all, or virtually all, a public relations approach to a very serious problem that does harm, terrible, terrible harm, to the lives and well-being of poor people and of New Yorkers of color.
So so-called community policing means, on a day-to-day basis, the same old crap that you see in arraignment court.
Right.
And in the South
right.
Bronx, it means arresting many of the youth in one night of a whole community.
Right. And, you know, there are other examples of bad practice. About a month ago, someone made a call to 911 emergency dispatcher that there was a woman in psychiatric crisis in her apartment, 66-year-old black woman. And the dispatcher sends the police, and an officer goes into her apartment, claims she attacked him with a bat, and he kills her. And one of the changes we're promoting now, and certainly we will during the electoral process next year, is to change entirely the 911 emergency call procedures. So right now, 911 is a unit of the police department. So we're recommending take the 911 division out of the police department, have the 911 dispatchers have at their disposal a list of mental health organizations, social service organizations, responsive church groups for every community and city. And when a call comes in about a mentally ill person behaving in a way that is endangering themselves or somebody else in the community, the dispatcher sends a mental health professional, not a police officer, to deal with the problem.
So it has come to this, that the New York City police cannot be trusted to respond humanely or intelligently to an emergency call on 911.
Well, certainly the police officers, most people become police officers not to deal with the problems of mentally ill people. Mental health professionals become mental health professionals because that's what they want to do. That's what they choose to do in their profession. So I am not even intending to criticize a police officer who handles that situation badly. I criticize a police officer who kills somebody. But it is inappropriate, inefficient, not smart, and sometimes very harmful to send a police officer, someone with a gun and a badge and a baton, into a situation dealing with a person in psychiatric crisis. Again, what's needed in those situations are mental health professionals who are trained, who are oriented, whose main professional purpose is to help people in those situations. And if there's a need for physical restraint, the decision to use physical restraint should be made by the mental health professional, not by the police.
And that's one of the reasons that many folks over generations in Black communities don't call the police for domestic disputes.
Right. And I think that's right. And if we had a smarter system, a more service-oriented 911 system, I think more people throughout the city, including certainly Black and brown New Yorkers, would be willing to seek emergency services, and the emergency services would be more beneficial, more humane, more effective. The political issue is, and the institutional issue is, the NYPD, and our guess is Mayor de Blasio will fall in line, will resist those kind of changes. Because those kind of changes, the changes we're talking about, would significantly reduce the power, responsibility, the budget, and the personnel of the police department.
And of course, the police union would resist as well.
Yes, and the police union is considered to be a very powerful institution. And again, if we do mount a protest campaign, we obviously, and certainly if I was a candidate, I obviously would not be looking to support from the police officers union, would not expect their support. And so we could take independent positions promoting what are the right things to do, what are the humane things to do, what are the sensible things to do, without having to worry about the political fallout from taking those kind of positions.
That was Bob Dangy of the Police Reform Organizing Project in New York.
Dr. Michael Dawson, the nation's premier Black social demographer, is director of the Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture at the University of Chicago. Dawson has done groundbreaking work mapping and identifying the political currents of Black American thought and action. He recently held a podcast conversation with two other eminent Black radical political scientists, Jason Jackson, a lecturer in the Department of Urban Planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and J. Philip Thompson, professor of urban planning at the University of Chicago. Dr. Dawson laid out the question for his colleagues.
One of the challenges, it seems to me, that when organizing started in the, well, didn't start in the 40s and 50s and 60s, but when it started winning some victories in the 50s and 60s, or that there were some very concrete goals that the Black movement, for example, focused on. It might be a stop sign in Richmond, California, which was part of how the Panthers got started to a significant degree. It could be the dismantling of Jim Crow, obviously a very large task, but one that involved massive organizing of literally millions of people across not just the southern United States, but throughout the United States. What are some of the concrete goals that particularly communities of color can be focused on over the next few years?
I've seen estimates by economists that it would cost about $600-700 billion a year to fully employ every unemployed able-bodied worker in America. And I've seen estimates that the real bailout of financial houses in 2008 was in the $10 trillion range. And we're talking about 1/20th of that being able to employ every able-bodied person in America. I think we're far past the point where everyone can be out of poverty, everyone can be employed, and I think the digital economy actually even offers greater opportunities for a generation of wealth collectively. Our way of thinking about the ownership and distribution of that wealth is locked into the 18th and early 19th century ideas and models of which capitalism is. And that is really, I think, the task of right now, is how do we rethink work, rethink distribution, rethink ownership fundamentally? And I think Obama missed huge opportunities to do that in 2008, but I don't think there's a body of ideas that he even was exposed to in order to think about how to use the takeover of General Motors as an opportunity for changing ownership or changing the way manufacturing happens in America. I don't think he ever had a clue about how to do that. And he was entirely focused on just preventing immediate collapse because of the speculative excesses of Wall Street. But we're at a point where it absolutely makes no sense to bail these folks out time and time again. And we could have, what would it mean for every able-bodied person in the U.S. to actually have a good job? And we're talking $50,000 a year if you read Poland's book or whatever. It would cost about $600 million a year. It's doable. So that's the moment where I think we are. And I think an agenda like that for the black community actually could resonate in white communities, actually could resonate in a lot of communities if we can put some arms and teeth around it.
Would you tie that to environmental concerns as well?
Absolutely. So the oceans are rising. There's been no serious attention to the infrastructure consequences of that. 2/3 of our population live in areas that are vulnerable to sea level rise. That alone, we're running out of fresh water. Our entire, and we grow half our food in deserts, and water has to be pumped in from a carbon standpoint. And it's just crazy. From a water conservation standpoint, it's crazy. We transport vegetables at 38 degrees, 1,500 miles on average, which is crazy. We haven't dealt with it. We could reduce 1/3 of our energy is heating buildings. That could be reduced by close to half through energy efficiency. 900,000 buildings in New York City alone need to be retrofitted. That's just one city. It's work for not one generation, for multiple generations. China is in the middle of building 13 high-speed rail lines simultaneously. We don't have one. There's trillions of dollars of work that would actually pay for itself that has to get done anyway for the survival of the planet. India and China have 1 billion people moving into cities in the next 10 years. They're building a city the size of Houston, every month. There is not enough concrete and steel, the raw materials, in the world to sustain this level of development for even 10 years. And so the need for research on green building materials and the production and manufacture of that is urgent in India. It's urgent in China. Opens up whole new arenas for manufacturing, for development that we could participate in along with others. And that's just one example. So I think the green economy opens up enormous sorts of opportunities for value generating manufacturing and production in the future. We're just not even talking about those things.
You know, one of the concerns I think that we have to be attuned to lies with the kind of models that are being offered to address environmental concerns. So the logic of markets as a means of organizing activity still remain dominant, even in arenas like environmental management. We see this, of course, with carbon markets, but in many other areas as well. And so if we're really to find solutions to these environmental challenges, it behooves us to rethink the logic of private ownership that Phil alluded to earlier, the logic that markets offer the most efficient and socially beneficial means of generating societally beneficial outcomes. in order to stem the global trends that we're seeing towards environmental degradation that are a fundamental outcome of contemporary capitalism.
I would agree, and I would also add that we really have to struggle against... It didn't start with neoliberalism. Neoliberalism accentuated this trend of assuming that the logical markets are the morality for all types of value systems. Whether we're talking about the environment, we're talking about the arts, we're talking about education, none of those arenas should be dominated by market values.
I actually don't think... I think markets are really a dumb instrument. A simple, dumb incentive system for getting people to do things. That's it. And I think all those... Karl Marx once wrote at the end of Grundy's long... He said, I wrote all this stuff to thousands of pages to explain to white workers what any slave knows intuitively. That all of this stuff, property relations, market, it's all made up. It's no necessity to it. And it's done to justify a power relationship. That's all I've been trying to say. And every slave who's captured and made to work already understands that intuitively. So what's complicated are not markets. Markets are a dumb tool. We can play with them too. What's complicated are all of these theories and justifications people put up to justify a power relationship. And I would agree with you on that. I just think that a lot of liberalism, a lot of liberal theory, a lot of what we call democratic theory are actually dressed up justifications for power domination of workers and people of color, etc. And that's where the logic is.
But he also added in Capital, not but, and he added in Capital that the evil genius of that was that it made people assume that they were free and equal. That's what the infrastructure was for.
And that's where the complications are.
Yeah.
Right. But it's not actually in markets. Market, there is no logic to markets. It's a simple, dumb instrument. You know, it's the more dangerous ideas, I think, are really, I really think it's been the degradation of, if you hold that some of the highest ideals of liberalism, John Dewey stuff, people should have an ability to pursue their own ends. People should treat each other with respect and respect other people's choices in their life. Things like that. People should... Liberal theory doesn't uphold that. Liberal theory throws that out the window and gets into a lot of justifications for inequality and ignoring real life and substituting sort of this idealizations of what real life is in order to justify the status quo. I think that's been the problem, and it's in political theory. It's in political science, probably more than it is in economics. I think economists don't even think about these things. They get caught up like engineers in pipes and valves and, you know, static pressures and things like that. They're not even thinking about these bigger issues. I think it's political science, sociology, some of these other disciplines that are even more culpable. Philosophy, even more culpable.
We can argue about economics. I'm at the University of Chicago.
if they were actually putting forward
Gary Becker and Milton Friedman.
Well, I think those are actually simple-minded theories when it comes to society. I don't think they have much to say at all. I don't think there's much there, actually. In terms of social theory, I don't think they have much social theory. I think of some of these other disciplines that are actually more pernicious. We could have that debate.
That
I mean, there's plenty of blame to go all the way around.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
I think people put so much on the economics profession, I don't even think that they are socially conscious of what the implications of their theories are. Or when they do talk about it, they make these grand assumptions that actually have no bearing on history, aren't connected to reality. But the disciplines that do look at history, do look at social relationships, I think they're even worse.
Yeah, I mean, conversations with economists remind me of conversations I had when I worked in engineering for 10 years.
Exactly. I'm at MIT, and I deal with them, and believe me, it's just like talking to engineers. Mm-hmm.
But one of the implications, or at least one of the questions that emerges from the claims you're making about the ability and necessity to, A, move to a green economy, B, to employ everyone, and C, to have different models of collective wealth accumulation, etc., is can that be done under liberal democracy?
Well, I mean, I think that's a good question, but I mean, it always depends on the actual institution. So liberal democracy is not infinitely elastic, but nevertheless can come in many institutional forms. So, of course, many people often look to the Northern European examples, for instance, for better distribution outcomes. And one doesn't have to get into a conversation about Denmark and Sweden, which is often not very helpful in other contexts. But ultimately, I think what we can say is that institutions are outcomes of ideas on one hand, and political the expending of political energies to convince people of the validity of those ideas on the other. And this is where I think the kind of liberal market outcomes that Phil was referring to have been successful, and where the work of people like Friedrich Hayek, von Mises, and of course Milton Friedman were very successful. So they laid a groundwork that contemporary political as well as economic actors are able to build on and is considered as second nature. So it's not even debated. But nevertheless, what it suggests, I think, for progressives is that we need to think very carefully about the kinds of institutions, kinds of institutional possibilities that can be put into play, and the kinds of organization that we need to have on the ground to convince people at various levels, not just at the elite level, but also at various levels of our already racially and economically stratified society, in order to build movements that can have the kinds of redistributional outcomes and that will be socially beneficial and environmentally beneficial as well.
I think that nation states as the sort of main vehicle that governs the economy and society ultimately needs to shrivel in importance, and that more robust forms of local democracy that actually engage people and that make that allow local folks to make more of their own decisions, I think that's where the future lies. And all kinds of ways that people in the U.S. can connect with other people socially and politically, because we already are connected economically, we just don't know it. Yeah. That so we can be more conscious about all of us, about the decisions we make. So, for example, Hayek said capitalism is an infinite information management system. And that's why centralized economies don't work, because you just can't manage that much information. But now with technology, we have the internet worldwide. And so if you buy a product, you could actually have a barcode on the product, and people could take their phone, snap the barcode, and find out what workers made this product, what they got paid, what the environmental impact was of this production facility. And they could actually compare those things and make decisions about what they want to buy on that basis, if they wanted to. So we have that capacity now to manage information in a way that ordinary people can actually make social and political decisions when they buy things, when they're engaged in the market. And so what does a governance structure look like when you have that kind of capacity? I would say the opportunity for movements in India of workers who work on the supply chain for Walmart to connect directly with consumers and purchasers here in the U.S., that could happen right now. We're in a country where labor has about a quarter of stock ownership in Wall Street, but exercises no real judgment about where those investments go. We're in a country where, to take New York State, where I'm familiar, the city comptroller is an elected official, manages $127 billion. On behalf of city workers, the state comptroller, another $150 billion. CalPERS in California manages about double that. And these folks could come together and make very different decisions, which would change what finance capitalism is if workers actually had voice and consciousness about what the implications were of their money going here versus there. All those things are possible right now. So I actually think that what Marx said about capitalism creating its own successor within it in the course of its own development, I actually think that's happened. If we look at some of these capacities that exist right now, I think we have plenty of material to think about what a system to replace it could look like. And for political scientists, I think we need to think about what would a governance structure, given those kinds of informational economic capacities that already exist, what kind of governance structures could actually build on that and facilitate that?
So if I could just pick up on that point. So one of the things, sort of going back to where Phil just started with Hayek and information that we have to think about with respect to governance, is what we're seeing, I think, is not a situation where we want to imagine a governance structure, but rather a situation where we have competing governance structures. So if we think about the role of information and platforms, for example, just in this recent election, with the role of Twitter, which is a platform for disseminating information, or Facebook, which is another platform for disseminating information, which many believe was hugely important in facilitating Trump's victory, it opens the question about what kind of information and whose information is deemed to be more or less legitimate, more or less truthful, if one can even use that term. It becomes a political question. And so even for to think about the role of information in linking different actors in the across the global economy, using the kind of digital infrastructures which are available, we also have to think about the competing governance structures, the actors that may be in charge, and the ways in which they may craft and shape different kinds of information and the kinds of political and economic effects they may have. So again, it's something to come back to that we're already talking about, which is that there's a central political economy questions that underpin these issues that come back to questions of power. And those are questions we fundamentally
have to figure out. And just on that, here's what I say to unions and community groups now. There's actually no magic in Facebook's architecture. It's not, what makes Facebook Facebook, which makes Twitter Twitter, is social cooperation. So people agree, we're going to use this platform to talk to each other, or that platform to talk to each other. That's what makes it powerful. Not that they have an exclusive hold on technology that no one else can replicate. You know, it's not like we're going to build General Motors in Detroit and, you know, no one else has that technology or capacity, and so you got to come to us. It's not like that. And so that means if we're conscious about what you're saying, what kinds of information we want, who controls it, how it's controlled, through organizing, we can actually take down a Facebook. We can take down a Twitter. We can put something else there. I think they're more sensitive that about that and aware of that than we are, and we being our communities and folks who use it. But I think in this new digital economy, there's a lot of opportunity for disruption. There's a lot of opportunity for taking power. It's just that political science, our disciplines are not really exposing that. They're far away from thinking about that. But I think the technology itself is not the problem.
We've been talking a lot about various possibilities, both short-range and long-range, for organizing government structures, economic structures, movements. What's the greatest danger we face over the next 4 years?
I think a continued fragmentation. So in the United States, maybe we can begin there. I think a continued fragmentation of the polity. I think a further strengthening of the far right, because I don't think we should just sort of say the right, because there are big gaps between what we typically have thought about as the right and the far right, which has become particularly powerful recently. Between those forces on one hand and progressive forces on the left, withering of the center, I think that is a serious concern. I think on the economic front, one of the ways in which a Trump administration could at least appear to be addressing some of the demands of the base from which it drew is through high levels of spending. So we can imagine under, even with the Republican House and Senate, bills being approved that facilitate big amounts of spending that can generate economic growth and that can be seen to be a reflection of a successful mode of economic management by a Trump White House, even while, of course, raising deficits. And traditionally, Democrats have been very vulnerable to this kind of action by Republicans because Democrats tend to be less concerned with deficit spending as a general matter. That's something we're familiar with. So I think that's also a threat on the economic front. Globally, I think, sort of falling on very similar terms, what's going to happen in other contexts that we haven't mentioned yet? So I start by saying that we've seen a shift to the right in Europe, obviously now in North America, and also in places like India. But interestingly, in the 2000s, what we saw in Latin America was a shift to the right, to the left.
Yeah.
And so what's going to happen in some of these other contexts? So Brazil, you know, if we're having this conversation 24 months ago, we'd be pretty happy about or very confident about Brazil. Brazil, of course, faces a huge crisis coming off of Dilma's impeachment. But nevertheless, what's happening in Latin America, what's happening in countries in both North and Sub-Saharan Africa, as well as other parts of Southeast Asia, are going to be really, really big questions. What kinds of shifts might we see in the political economy in these countries will have big implications for where we go globally?
Well, I don't think that Donald Trump or the right-wing elements in Brazil or the Brexit folks have any economic solutions to the workers, displaced workers who are demanding better lives. In the 70s, I think the financial sector in this country was about 7%. Of the economy. Today, they're over 40% of the economy, and they aren't delivering investments into industries and things that create good jobs or actually better lives, manufacturing things that people in the world would buy because it makes their lives better. They're not doing that. It's all extraction. And I don't see the right having any alternative to that. And I think the results of that are going to be increasing polarization. So Trump won't be far right enough for some folks. They're going to want to double down and become more militaristic. Just take things that, you know, they think, you know, will help Americans or dominate other countries, more war. We're already in perpetual war, but double down on that. And so I think there's a real danger of neo-fascism in this country, and rounding up of immigrants is dangerous, and it erodes basic liberties that we've come to expect. I think that's a real danger. And in a country that practiced racial segregation until I was in junior high school, I fully believe that Americans are capable of those kinds of policies and that kind of mentality. On the other hand, given the global climate crisis, given the absolute that there are real alternatives to going down this road, that some countries in Latin America and elsewhere began to show that you could actually do things differently, I think there's an opportunity for progressive folks worldwide to come forward with alternatives right now. And I think even some of these new tech companies and others will want to be supportive of an alternative. And so I think we're out of stability. I don't see a scenario of stability in the future. I think we have no choice but to fight what will become, I believe, an increasingly angry working class. And there will be people wanting to take advantage of that to move in very different directions.
One of the things that I hope we can learn from the far right is to rebuild some of these global networks. I was talking to some members of a European consulate this week, and they were talking about how their country is facing an election in a few months and how the far right was extraordinarily energized. But those ties, those organizational yeah. ties were already there. Yeah. And the right has been very, I mean, organizations that were considered fringe, like Stormfront, have been very, very systematic in building ties across the, at least North Atlantic. We can learn some lessons from that.
One thing I did like about Leo Panitch's book, The Making of Globalization, he pointed out that neoliberalism was a tremendous intellectual project, and that the G20 met regularly, the Treasury departments, every 6 weeks throughout the 60s and early 70s. They met and exchanged papers and had dealt extraordinary to come up with the mechanisms, the legal structure, the ideas that would facilitate trade across a whole bunch of different countries under their control, right? Extraordinary. And then the far right has been doing that. And when you look at what the left does by comparison, like the social, what is it, the World Social Forum, whatever, right. which in my mind is more like a party than a... like not a political party, more
I
like
know what you meant.
You know, a hanging out party, as opposed to serious, intense, organized, disciplined work. And I agree. I think that is a necessity yeah. if we're going to figure out how to fight.
And one of the things that Phil has been harping on the entire time we've been talking, and I think this might be a good place to close on. Part of that work has to be intellectual. We have to think about what's next. We have to analyze structures and capacities and try to figure out where the fulcrums are to move some of these.
And I think some of the challenges that are going to emerge there that we need to be aware of is the nature of the support that we may get for this kind of progressive intellectual work and progressive activism that's needed. So much of the support for the ideas of neoliberalism, going back to the Mont Pelerin Society, support for a variety of think tanks that emerged really from the shadows to the center of American politics, American Enterprise Institute, Cato Institute, and so forth in the 1980s, rested on financial support from certain aspects of capital, not all. One doesn't want to be too simple about thinking about capital even in the United States. Today, we sort of think of tech capital as being a possibility for support for progressive ideas and progressive initiatives. And I would just signal a bit of caution, simply because much of the ideas and beliefs that I believe mobilize or sort of underpin many Silicon Valley sort of tech entrepreneurs and Silicon Valley capital themselves are quite libertarian.
Absolutely.
And so this is, libertarian ideas are, can be used perhaps in some ways in support of progressive ideas, but then also, they, of course, they have their own history. So that's something for us to be cautious about. Especially, again, given what we said about the role of technology companies in controlling information. So through the algorithmic methods that they use and through their ability to amass significant amounts of capital. So the kind of network effects and monopoly, propensities towards monopoly that we've observed. So I think those are really big questions for us. How do we organize? What kinds of support is available? What role do other institutions play? Of course, universities, which we've kind of talked about in the abstract, but maybe not directly today, are questions for us to really think about going forward.
I actually think universities are one of the institutions not completely captured by corporate capital or government, at least not everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's really important right now. When you think about where are places that can actually help seed alternative ideas, universities actually have capacity to do that. And there aren't many other institutions I can think of that do. I also think that in terms of leadership and support for coming up with new programs, new agendas, a lot of it will come from the quote-unquote global south or from the non-European or U.S. Countries, or even if you look in Europe, from places you might not expect. So the leading person calling for conversations and organizing amongst workers of color right now is Roger McKenzie, who's the Secretary Treasurer of the British Public Sector Workers Union, who's Afro-British, and he is a leader in calling for this. A lot of Latin American countries have been calling for this. And when you think about tech, I don't think we have a quote-unquote class analysis of the tech industry in the way that people did of the finance sector or manufacturing. I don't think we even have that right now. There's an open source movement in the tech world that's kind of politically all over place. It has some libertarian tendencies, but it's really different from a Facebook. And so I just think we have to carefully analyze, you know, this period right now in order to figure out how to move.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.